This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. It's episode 350 of the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast. I'm Jamie Bogner, and joining me here in the Craft Beer and Brewing Studios in Fort Collins, in a rare live recording here in our own studio, is Kelly McKnight, lead R&D brewer for New Belgium. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you.
Been big fan. Obviously, we're neighbors with New Belgium here in Fort Collins, and so we figured we might as well use this studio that we've padded out and soundproofed and everything else to get a nice, clean, and quiet recording environment.
It's pretty in here.
I wouldn't call it pretty, but it is quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, I've spent plenty of time over New Belgium over the years, and I'm very familiar with what the team there is doing. But Kelly leads up R&D, and that means you are one of those primary movers behind this crazy hazy IPA, juicy juice force, all of these beers that seem to be defying the gravity of the current beer world and finding huge amounts of growth while the rest of beer is trying to make its way through this year. It's a tough time for a lot of brewers, but New Belgium is just, you know, this bright spot in finding growth in that space.
Yeah, it's crazy. We've grown double digits every single month in sales volume since the start of the pandemic. So it's nuts.
Absolutely wild. And of course, you know, part of that means constantly creating new products to feed into this product pipeline and this family of beers that you all are building and expanding and expanding. And so we're going to talk about how you go through that R&D process and how these things go from ideation to actual beers and how you do all of that. Before we do that, at G&D Chillers, they always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer. Kevin Toger from Bearded Iris Brewing says G&D Chillers has been a valuable partner throughout our growth. They build high quality equipment and know their machines extremely well. Most importantly, their customer service is best in class, which is a huge value add to our internal teams that manage these critical support systems. End quote. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring on your new G&D Chiller. And Pro Brew is changing the game at this year's CBC in Las Vegas. As part of ProMoc Craft Beer Solutions, they're presenting a holistic approach to craft brewing operations. Through their display of animations, holograms, and machinery, they'll be highlighting how they can advance every aspect of your production line. Visit go.probrew.com/CBC24 or contact them at contactus@probrew.com to schedule one-on-one time with one of their subject matter experts at booth 1783 at this year's show. Pro Brew, brew your beer. Also, Old Orchard has supplied flavored craft juice concentrate blends to over 46 states for the production of fruit-forward beer, cider, seltzer, wine, spirits, and more. By partnering with some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape, Old Orchard has become a go-to source for fruit-forward ingredients. To learn more and request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. All right, Kelly, give me your story. What got you into brewing? What got you into beer? And then how did that segue into, I want to build a career brewing beer?
Yeah. Well, first off, mentioned I'm getting over a cold, so might sound a little stuffy.
The entire world has a cold right now. We all sympathize. I was listening to podcasts I did down in Phoenix. Like, I sound sick.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, you're among friends here.
Okay, cool. How did I get into beer? Let's see. 2001, moved out to Seattle to go to the University of Washington and started homebrewing in our dorms, actually. One of my friends, her dad, classic Northwest homebrewer, got me into it. So we had a hot plate in there, and that was fun. Didn't think anything of it. Finished undergrad, was still in Seattle for a little bit, homebrewing when I had time. And then I moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts to go to finish up pre-med and study chemistry at Harvard. And that was not the best time of my life, just because it was obviously pretty stressful. And
Pre-med at Harvard, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I wasn't used to, even though we're in Colorado, and I grew up here in Fort Collins, I wasn't so used to these crazy nor'easter blizzards, so life was a little tough out there. But
it's 60 degrees and sunny in February here in Fort Collins. Like, it's lovely.
Yeah, so what happened there? I would kind of homebrew when I had any free time. And at the time, I was also working at a craft beer bar, and anybody in that region would know it. It's called Cambridge Common, so they have 30 beers on draft. And back then, 2007, 2008 was when I first got out there. You know, it was like Victory Golden Monkey, and they'd actually get Boulder beer in, and it was the craft place. So anyway, I was working there through school, and one day I was just super stressed and said, fuck everything, I'm going to homebrew. And I did, and I just remember feeling joy. It was like, oh my God, I haven't smiled in a while like this, right? And so I called my parents, and I'm like, hey, I'm not going to go to medical school. I'm going to be a brewer. And I bet
that went over really well.
Actually, it did. Really? I always get, it's usually by older people, but because at New Belgium, you're going to do tours and tell your story sometimes. But they're like, oh, weren't your parents so disappointed in you? And I was like, no, they're fucking excited because I wasn't going to be $400,000 in debt. And they've always been rad. When I grew up here, I was a sponsored skateboarder, snowboarder. So they were driving me all around the country to do that stuff. And so when I said I wanted to be a brewer, they're like, great. Makes you happy. We're on board. So finished school right around then. And then I went to the Cambridge Common to the managers who at the time, they were in the works, Kate and Suzanne, they were getting ready to start the chain called Craft Beer Cellar.
Yeah.
So that hadn't launched yet, but I said, hey, I want to be a brewer, blah, blah, blah. And they go, good luck, or they go, good news, you're in luck, because whether you knew it or not, Cambridge Common would host all these amazing beer dinners with famous brewmasters. And I was always like, why are these people staying way late after to tell me their story? Well, the whole time, Kate and Suzanne had said they would tell them that I was going to be a brewer, whether I knew it or not. So when I told them that I wanted to be one, back in the day, remember Constant Contact, they said, write up a bio, they sent it out. And the next day I got tons of job offers. Remember, I had never brewed professionally, right?
Sure.
And that was in my bio. It just said basically I studied chemistry at Harvard, which was what I had going for me. And so I actually took a job offer at a terrible, horrible, shitty brew pub in a suburb of Boston, Waltham, Massachusetts. It was called Watch City Brewing Company. So it was one of those classic 90s brew pubs, Peter Austin system, wood clad, open fermenter, fermenters with a lifetime supply of Ringwood ale yeast. Yeah, it's just a shit show. So anyway, I started there and quickly became head brewer. And that actually was even though that place was a dump, and that's where my best friend, Lee Lord, who's now the head brewer at Narragansett, she was my assistant brewer. After, I think, about a year or two, she came on board. So we together, not to make this about the two of us, but it was a very bonding situation.
Sure. Adversity brings you together.
Oh my God, this place was awful. And again, most brewers have all brewed at somewhere that just sucked. And it did, but I had the freedom to make anything I wanted. And so I was a new brewer, the only guardrails I had were everything breaking, but as far as recipe and ideation, I could make anything I wanted. And so I actually focused a lot on Belgian beers. That's kind of where my heart lies. If you had to, ask the question, what's your favorite beer? It was just in Brussels. And as soon as I got to the bar, that was serving West V12s. I was just like, all right, it's on. I will make the train. But yeah, so I worked with all kinds of crazy ingredients, especially back then. And so anyway, that's where my creative brewing started. And then, of course, that place sucked. I was trying to move back to Seattle to be a head brewer. And at the time, Seattle only had like, I mean, there was Mac and Jack's, but and Pyramid, Legion, and they hadn't sold yet or anything. And then there was Seattle Brewing. So there, other than those, there was like, I don't know, maybe three other small breweries. So it was hard, right, to find a head brewer job out there. And then out of the blue, actually never applied to New Belgium. I got a 970, which is our area code here in Colorado, or one of the area codes. Phone was ringing, and I was on the brew deck with Lee, and I answered it, and it was a person who used to work at New Belgium. Her name is Tamar Banner, and she's actually now the head brewer at Tuol in Denmark. But she said, hey, you're our top choice. We know you grew up here. Do you want to come brew for us and move home? Which, first of all, amazing job offer. But I also had vowed to never move home. So I was like, yay. Oh, shit. And of course, my parents were freaking out. Lee was like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Because I just turned white. But yeah, I accepted it. I moved out here, back here in 2014. I started at New Belgium as a production brewer and actually begged to be on nights. So I worked nights for 5 years. 4 years. And actually, while I was in production, New Belgium gave me tons of awesome opportunities. And Tamar, who had called me when I was there, at one point she was my boss, but she had really good advice. She was like, and I had sworn, like, I'll never work production, right? Coming from running a small brewery.
You're a brew pub and all this freedom.
Yeah.
A lot of Ringwood yeast, but still a lot of freedom.
Well, I quickly changed the Ringwood went to Chico and Belgians right away. Yeah. But she was like, use it as a grad school. Because New Belgium, right, like we are lucky enough to have microbiologists, like all of our sensory department, QA, amazing brewers who've been there now, like Maddie on my team, he's been there 27 years. He's Mr. Voodoo after Ross left. We'll talk about him a little bit. But I did. I
Mr.
used
Mr. Voodoo.
Yeah.
Is that an official title?
No, it's not. But yeah, so I just studied my ass off. I took every educational opportunity that came my way. And then probably in 6 years ago, I don't even know what year it is now, 2024. So maybe, yeah, I would say 2018. We do have a pilot brewery at New Belgium. It's a 10 hectoliter NSI system, and it's right in the middle of our wood cellar, which is kind of shitty, actually, because you don't really want all of the infected beer and air floating around your clean cellar. But I started.
But you guys have such good SOPs that that's not an issue, right, Kelly?
Of course, they're perfect. Every single one's up to date. But yeah, I started rotating through there because it was at the time original pilot brewer Cody Reif, who's now my boss. It was him. It was Ross Koenigs, who you said has been on the show before, and Ross actually ended up opening his own brewery in Denver called Second Dawn. Shout out.
And if subscribers to Craft Beer and Brewing, All Access subscribers want, they can watch a video class that we did with Ross Koenigs last year on brewing with cannabis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ross. And he has the book.
And he's got the book. But we've got the video class.
Which is better than the book. Just kidding, Ross.
You get to hear Ross in his own dulcet, deep voice.
We call it old-timey radio voice.
Exactly.
But yeah, it was Cody, Ross, and they were overwhelmed. They needed another brewer. I started working in the pilot as like the assistant pilot brewer. And then, I don't know, 5 years later, I'm the lead R&D brewer. And it's been great. I think, you know, all that experience I had at the dump in Boston, gave me, it kind of flowed right in with the team because, again, and we'll get into this. I think you have some questions on how we make all of the beers we do, but it was great. We just vibed. And so it's been awesome. And yeah, I've been in the pilot 5 years, New Belgium 10 years.
So that little pilot crew is it's also kind of like, you know, pirate group within the New Belgium, just like the Wood Cellar is kind of its own. There's a little, because it's such a, robust brewing organization, you build your crews within the bigger and broader crew.
Yeah, let me take a sip of beer. Kelly's Tropical Ale.
Kelly's
AKA Beer de Queer.
Beer de Queer. I'll take one with you.
I love that beer. Yeah, so our crew is actually really small. Let's see, we have Matt Gilliland or Matty Smooth. Like, he's the one who's been there 27 years in all forms of brewing, but now in R&D. So he took over after Ross, and he's mainly, we're kind of split up. So Matty does all of our hoppy stuff. We have Dave Glore, raw material sourcing extraordinaire. But brewer, R&D brewer. So he works on like kind of non-traditional stuff. So flavors and ordering in all the craziest berries and honey and crap. He finds stuff from all over the world, but also make sure, hey, if this becomes a 100,000 barrel brand, could these people actually supply it?
Right. Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, really. I think one time we about the world's supply of soursop, but that's okay. We're different now. We wouldn't do that to the world. So yeah, we've got Maddie on hops, Dave on like fruits and natural flavors and things like that. Cody, the OG pilot brewer, he's our boss. So Cody kind of works on everything with us. And then I kind of float in between and do all of our really cool small batches, experiment with a lot of just crazy materials. And who else do we have in there? Oh, and we have Trevor. He's was the assistant pilot brewer, but I think he just got promoted to R&D brewer. So he's kind of does the day-to-day. But our team splits everything up. So there's only, Maddie, Dave, Cody, me, five of us. And as we either come up with really cool.
There's only five of you in the R&D program, not even for the production brewing side, just the R&D program. No, I mean, but that's obviously the scale the New Belgium is at and the frequency of the beers you all are putting out and also feeding tap room, so that these small beers can provide a unique experience for people to come in. I mean, it all kind of feeds together. Sure.
And it's, even right now, I wouldn't say we're bursting at the seams, but we're pretty. Our team has a lot of projects we're messing around with. And, if you think about it, we have our core brands. We have to redo different versions as materials change per year, like your grain and everything like that, hop harvests and things. But we have Asheville, Fort Collins, now Daleville. And so we're just at max capacity also. And so we're trying to that's another part of R&D, right? Is we're trying to make all of our awesome beers, but how do we fit them in across the board at these different places, utilize all our space since we can't make beer fast enough and be super efficient. So a lot of our R&D is also part of something that I kind of am an expert in is I know our production system really well. Obviously we have our brewmaster, Christian, and all that kind of stuff. But as far as small batch, small scale, working to come up with new recipes, I specialize in knowing, okay, this will totally destroy Brewhouse 2 or hey, maybe the runoff will be great. But yeah, that's how our team's kind of split up. And then we're just a tight-knit crew. So if Trevor or anybody comes to the table and is like, I saw this somewhere, blah, 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 then we'll start messing around with it. And we're lucky to have the ability to get a lot of ingredients, whether it's from hop vendors, or just crazy new weird shit.
Sure. Cause you're New Belgium.
I, I think yes, it's different than the old brew pub.
For sure. Well, I want to talk more about how you all pull ideas together, how you all evaluate ideas, how you all then take some of these ideas and start to realize them in the form of beer. You know, what that kind of iterative process looks like. You know, development cycles, et cetera, et cetera. Before we do that, streamline efficiency with Omega Yeast's Diacetyl Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now for made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They're proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you, whether you're just starting out or looking to expand. Contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, we are brewers. And if you're a brewer who's also interested in distilling, subscribe now to the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast, available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Hosted by Sydney Jones, head distiller for Few Spirits in Chicago, and Molly Troop, master distiller for Freeland Spirits in Portland, Oregon, this podcast explores the technical and creative processes behind great spirits through conversations with some of the leading distillers working today. It's everything you love about the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, but focused on distilling. Click on the link in the show notes and give it a listen. All right, Kelly, let's talk about this R&D process a little bit. I imagine ideas come from all sides. They come from the brewing staff. They also have to be coming from the sales and marketing staff. They're coming from, fellow brewers. You're pulling inspiration. You're seeing what's going on out there. Then they're coming from yourselves. You're tasting new things. And then you have suppliers that are also bringing some ideas and ingredients and things that they are trying to, find places for. How do you all then kind of, take all of these ideas and start testing them, making decisions about these things? Like, walk me through a process for a typical beer. I'm curious about that.
Oh, boy. So let's start off with we're pretty dynamic, right? So
sure. I also just like to ask the biggest possible questions with so many things just to overwhelm you like that.
Okay, so we have a lot of trust between, marketing and our team. So stuff doesn't always, it's not one-sided. So let's see, for instance, I could be, like I said, finding all these ingredients, Dave getting them in, and we all do a lot of benchtop work, I'll just pull the trigger and make these 10 hectoliter batches, but I would say, yeah, we do tons of benchtop. So
what does benchtop then look like in terms of process for you guys?
Benchtop could look like...
like you have a standard beer that you then, put stuff in, or is it, what you have, or, yeah.
I mean, yeah, benchtopping would be, we'll make like a base lager that hits whatever spec we want for ABV and mouthfeel, body, and just... attenuation and things like that. And then from there, mess around with it, with different hops, with different natural flavors, with different juices, with things like that. And spices. And if you're not that sure, right? If it's a project.
Right, now, when you say you mess around with that, are you talking about taking, graduated cylinders and making small blends? Are you talking about 1 gallon carboys? Are you talking about, do you have, some larger but small stainless steel, homebrew vessels? Or what kind of scale does that work at?
It would be brewing a 10 hectoliter batch of it, kegging it off, and then just taking that base and on the bench, which is just the pilot countertop, pipetting. The OG way is what I like to do. So, making like a tincture with honeysuckle or with whatever it is and kind of dosing it in and just seeing how that performs. That's kind of what it looks like. And then from there.
A tincture with just a neutral spirit of some sort?
Or a tea or something like that. And then we'll whip up like some sort of samples and fill some pitchers and take it and have actually tastings. And I came here from two different tastings in a row, which I can't talk about what they are.
Sure.
But how those look is we'll bring in the pitchers of what we think is cool. And that could be something that marketing asks for. It could be something that we just came up with. That's what I was saying. There's like that trust. So it's not just a one-way street marketing telling us what to do. But we'll go in there. We'll invite, you know, the stakeholders, I guess you could say, the people who have the say. And one thing that's cool about – and so that would be like marketing, sensory department, our team, our brewmaster – Lauren Limbach, she's one of our innovation specialists too. I mean, she's wood cellar, but obviously has a,
she's got a pretty solid palate.
She kind of knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
And so then we'll talk about it and maybe it's those things. I mean, like one today, the first one today, kind of was back and forth with this particular beer. But then the next one, it was like a slam dunk. And when that happens, which is not always the case, that's great because that means all of those people are on board. If not, we have to go back to the drawing board, which is okay because that's what innovation is, and tweak it and maybe brew an actual 10 hectoliter batch of it and just be like, here it is. And so we have a lot of versions of different things, like, you know, when we redid Fat Tire, I think we made 8 different versions. Mm-hmm. And that's also funny because that just came straight from our brewmaster. And that recipe redo, which I know my dad actually called me. He's like, you've made the biggest mistake of your lives. And I was like, okay, when's the last time you drank a Fat Tire? And he's like, 20 years ago? I'm like, shut up. I love my dad. But that redo actually had a lot to do with sustainability. And we can talk about that in more detail if we want, but we have to be carbon neutral by 2030. So we had to take a deep dive. Christian, our brewmaster, Christian Holbrook, was in charge of that project. And so looking at, you know, the carbon footprint for roasting, you know, malting barley and all that, and what does that mean? And so that actually was part of that whole rebrand. But yes, so
lower energy use from lighter kilning was featured into the whole recipe.
And raw barley.
Okay.
But then, and that's another direction too. It's like, okay, this brand is sort of dying. It's not dead. It's still got a lot of shelf space and people love it. But what do we do? It's a compelling brand.
Yeah.
For me, it's funny because I've always had Fat Tire with off-flavor spikes, the old Fat Tire.
Sure.
For 9 years, and I really like the new one, just because it was like a whole new...
Doesn't carry that association for you.
But it was like, with that rebrand, it was like, how do we innovate to make younger people want to drink it, right? And now it's crazy because I'm out at the Lyric or bars around town. Lyric's like a local cinema. And you hear young people ordering it, people in their 20s, which is like, that would have never happened before. I mean, it happened 20 years ago and then they all got older and, stopped drinking it. But yeah, so innovation, like going back to the bench topping, we'll make stuff, we'll make prototypes, we'll bring in a couple versions of this, that, and the other. Either everyone signs off on it and it's great, or it basically gets shit on and someone doesn't like this, and then we rework it. And then there's like a lot of beers that I do, and Maddie Gilliland, Mr. Voodoo, we do innovation in a different way where we work with all of our, you know, hop vendors and stuff and get in the latest, coolest, newest hops that, you know, a lot of them are not commercially named yet.
Sure.
Or cool hop products. And Maddie and I, for the last like year and a half, have just been pulling the trigger on all these single hop beers. And that's nothing that's unheard of. But we'll do those. We'll analyze them. I mean, analytical, we'll analyze them, test them. We'll measure like all of the different organic acids in them and then do tastings.
Yeah, kind of nice that you have your own lab with GC mass spec and you can get more analytical data on these beers than than most folks out there at breweries.
It is crazy. And that's actually interesting too, because especially with all the single hop or let's say we put, Mosaic anchovy, shout out to
Siegel.
But if we put all those in there, we can start to see across the board which each one's what each hop brings to the table. And so we can do studies, and then maybe next time Maddie and I want to make a beer, we're like, okay. And even though you get all this information from each hop supplier and they're, you know, obviously they're doing their own testing, you know, it's a little bit different system to system. So we compile all that and we'll be like, okay.
Whatever your selection is might be just a little bit different than some of, you know.
Yeah. So if we want.
It's not like they can run that full thing on every single lot that they're selling. That would be crazy expensive.
Yeah. And a lot of time. but yeah, Maddie and I will be like, okay, we want it to smell like raspberries and do-do-do-do-do. And whether it's a fruited or not beer, we'll kind of do that. Those beers, like I said,
you know what those compounds are that are going to produce that raspberry feel, and you can, you know, kind of find that within your library of data from the
yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
That's even better than matching up the, you know, little flavor graphs, spiral graphs, or circle graphs.
It is. And yeah. We also, you know, we have Stacey Williams, an amazing scientist. She's also a hop expert, but she's an analytical constantly testing any new hops, and so we'll get information from her. But those, so like I said, we'll bench top, or Maddie and I will do single hop, collect data from those. And then a lot of the beers that I make on my own, so not the hop projects with Maddie or anything like that, I just go for it. I just go, I know all this shit's gonna taste good, let's do it. And then those end up becoming most of our taproom beers, to like, you know, mess around and see what the consumer thinks. So there's that. And then another input for R&D is Lauren, right? So in the pilot, not every beer that Lauren puts out, but half maybe, of her limited releases, we'll make the base beer in the pilot, and that could have maple syrup. Who knows what's in there? But then Lauren will do like all of the blending and all that. So when we create a beer with her, it's R&D in a different way, right? Because she's a whole different process. And so, you know, we need her input, and no one's going to get a prototype of that, right? That's unique, and it's just going to happen. But obviously with her expertise,
she's earned the right to bypass the normal prototyping process.
Yes. So,
I believe it.
Those are, that R&D is really just, okay, these smell good, or whatever herb, spice, juice it is, and let's go for it. So it's kind of crazy. We do a lot of juggling, I guess. But yes, it's not one streamlined process. I think the only thing that's in common with all of, not even all of them, 90% of these beers is like, if it is going to be a bigger brand, we just like get approval and kind of also get told, don't fuck it up.
Sure. Well, I want to dive a little bit deeper into this whole hop question, because I love this idea that you all are profiling your own, you know, hop selections and able to use, you know, this pretty deep scientific information about flavor and aroma compounds to not just, you know, combine things or find the ways that those hops interact with each other, but also finding other pathways to similar flavors and, finding other ways to construct that. So I want to dive into that a little bit more, but before we do, SS Brewtech was founded by a group of home and craft beer brewers dedicated to bringing an engineering-first approach to brewery equipment. SS Brewhouses are used to formulate new beer recipes at some of the world's greatest breweries, into the cornerstone of many local breweries. To learn more about SS Brewtech's innovation list, head on over to ssbrewtech.com. Also, some brewers want their water profile to be that of their city, and that sounds great, except for one factor. Depending upon the city and the day, the water quality can vary 40 to 50%, so a Monday brew can taste very different from a Thursday brew. Savvy brewers know this, since beer is like 95% water. The best method is to start with the same water every time, and reverse osmosis gives you that power. Visit uswatersystems.com for a free expert analysis. So say you're, you know, just theoretical, just spitballing here. Say you need to come up with, you know, a few new, you know, Voodoo Ranger, Hazy IPA, Imperial variants to kind of keep the ball rolling on this juggernaut of a beer brand that's, you know, seeing this crazy growth according to Nielsen IRI numbers. You know, there's, you know, you're working now, your hop vendors are, you know, sharing their newest and their latest with you. You're trying to, you always need to build a new story there, and you all have built new stories, whether that's in the hop variety or whether that's adding, you know, different fruit additions or flavor additions to those. How do you, you know, talk to me about that process and how you all might, given so many options and that's kind of broad breadth, like, you know, come into, you know, some pathways forward.
Oh man. It's crazy, right? The possibilities are endless. And, you know, if you look at all the beer memes, it's just like same base beer, different.
Citra Mosaic. Yeah.
So how do we deal with that?
Maybe a little bit of lactose.
No, not for us anymore. No. Let me start with the story of Juice Force. This is hilarious because it wasn't a conventional route for us. And it's what, the number one craft launch of all time. Okay, so here's how we came up with that one. Cody Reif, the time, who was on our team? Is Cody, Ross, Dave, me, Maddie wasn't there yet. So, so with Juice Force, basically, we were doing a standard tasting for some other project, right? Some other beer. And we actually worked with natural flavors. And at that time, Cody picked out basically his three favorite ones. And we're like, you know what? Because we always try to cast a wide net for our innovation. What's popular? What's trending? And at the time, it was everything was Imperial. Everything was hazy. What else was popular? That seltzers were popular at the time. So natural flavors. So we're like, what if we just combined all of those? So anyway, we're going to this other tasting. And Juice Force literally was the smallest amount that Cody could pipette into a crowler and top up with Juicy Haze and seal it. And we brought it in. And at the end of the original tasting, we poured it. And it, like, blew all of their minds. And that's how that was made. So there was really no rhyme or reason to that one.
So he basically just took this blend of natural flavors that he was super stoked on, pipetted it into this existing...
A crowler. Topped it up
and,
with Juicy Haze.
And that was it.
That is how we did it. Yes. And then, you know, that was like the first prototype.
Serious homogenization, and, you know, like real process there.
That was the first prototype. But then, you know, once, because that's a thing, right? Nobody on that marketing team was going there, right? So we kind of blew their gourds. And then obviously process wise, and they were like, you can make this. And we kind of lied. we're like, yeah. And then within a few weeks, it was in the hands of like Kroger buyers. So then it really became a thing. I mean, we had to make it, right? At that point when they liked it. So then it was insane, like struggling how to figure out to get this to market on our existing systems. But it's New Belgium and we always find a way. I think our process engineers were going a little nuts there. But yeah, we got it to market. so
fast. I love that brewing involves process engineers because, you know, for you, when you're filling a 2,000 barrel tank, you know, it is much more than just a, hey, how are we going to ferment this? Like, it's it is a big, you know, production undertaking to think about, you know, brewing beer at that kind of scale.
It is. It really is. And shout out also to one of our, I mean, he was a brewer, Andy Mitchell. We call him our wizard. He moved from brewing into process engineering. And see, that's the thing that we have to think about, right? The crap, well, we didn't with Juice Horse, but the crap that we come up with has to be, you know,
scalable
and not ruin everything. And so that one was a doozy, but we pulled it off. But yeah, that's how we came up with it. It was crazy. And there's been other ones that were so simple. I remember during COVID, 1985 was a similar story. And 1985 is the Mango IPA. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to Dave Glore because he, whether it's, again, yeah, we are using some natural flavors, of course, it says it on the can. And that's a whole new thing for brewing these days. But with our hops and with our raw materials, like, that's the thing we have. We have the catalog and we constantly test. So, like, you know, raspberry from sourced out of one country from this certain vendor is going to taste and perform way different than this other one. And we know that because we spend, I mean, it's our job. We spend many hours each day just testing all this stuff in the pilot, screwing around with it and just trying to figure out when or if this is ever scalable. Will it be good? And that way, like, for instance, if we get marketing sending us an idea, we'll be like, oh, remember 4 years ago when we had this certain, you know, type of hop or mango or something like that? Then we can, like, pull together and say, okay, this is going to be perfect, hopefully. But yeah, that's I don't even know if I answered your question, sure. But that's the story of Juice Force.
Do you institutionalize that knowledge somehow? Because, I mean, some of that, if it depends on the individuals, you know, if somebody leaves, then that leaves a hole in that kind of knowledge base.
No, we don't.
Okay.
No, it's all in our heads, really. No,
that's fair. Then a different kind of question, you know, as you're thinking about, you know, as you mentioned before, using natural flavors within, you know, this kind of IPA space, you know, if you're using just natural flavors, then that flavor can come across as thin, you know, and yet people want that kind of fullness in the flavor spectrum. You know, for like we think about it even within not just the hoppy space, that using just modern flowable hop products without, you know, some hops with vegetal matter can leave the flavor not feeling quite as ranging as, you know, as people expect out of it. How have you guys found that, you know, working those flavors into IPA, you know, how do you make them successful and give this big, broad spectrum of flavor?
I mean, as the recipe designers, that's, you know, a huge part of it, right, is water chemistry to get that mouthfeel and balance. And we have an amazing sensory program, sensory department. And so even if it's just like a base beer that might have natural flavors, we do extensive sensory panel testing. So, and that panel is anybody who works for us, right? There are some people who are super tasters, but we go from there. And
we personally love this program that you have because some of our blind panel judges are New Belgium employees that have been well trained, including Andy, like you mentioned earlier, Soren, another one, you know, very skilled tasters, you know, who then, of course, you know, also judge beer on their spare time for us.
Yeah. And so the panelist, I mean, you could be a novice panelist, that's fine. Or you could be like Soren or Andy, you could be these amazing panelists that are really good at these certain attributes. And we track it, that we track that. Like when I was regularly on panel, I mean, I knew I was, kind of shitty at caprylic, and then you can work and train and get really hard, but you're also learning the other attributes, right? Like you're learning mouthfeel, body, everything. And so when we have those tastings, so of Juice Force or any new brand, they're evaluating it, and all the, and every single beer. I mean, like, we meet with Sensory constantly, and technically they're our biggest customers, right? The pilot, we want, that's where we're going. That's where we need to make these people happy. And, you know, they'll give feedback. Thin body, didn't match the target. And so that's when we go back to the drawing board and we change our, again, mash profiles or this, that, and the other grain bill to achieve just an all-around good product that you want to, in my opinion, chug.
Chuggable. That's the standard for you.
Yeah, for me. And my goal is to be like, okay, I made something that someone could drink 3 or 4 pints of. That's my goal.
Sure.
Should be
sure.
Anybody's goal as a brewer, but I don't know.
That is generally the definition of good beer, a beer that you want to drink another one and then order a third or a fourth on top of it. Sure, sure. You know, are there any other, you know, tricks that you use for layering those kinds of flavors to help those natural flavors work well with, you know, say, traditional hop flavors to, you know, because you do sell these as IPAs and, you know, there is that expectation that there's a little bit of bitterness, not very much, not anymore, not, you know, these days.
The new world of IPA.
A little bit of bitterness, but that strong hop character and flavor is important there.
Tricks that we use, we do hop the shit out of everything.
Oh, yeah.
We, process-wise, we're lucky enough, we have a new that Andy actually helped commission, Andy Mitchell, but we have a great new dry hopping system. And that's a huge part, right? And I know these are buzzwords and things, but over the last 5-6 years, everyone's been studying biotransformation, all this and that. But what's crazy is with the volume that we brew per tank, per, you know, 1440 hectoliter or whatnot, we can be so exact of when it's going to hit whatever dry hop temp we want, mid-firm dry hop temp. So when it hits 6C, when it hits 8C, whatever you're looking for, to be ready to track it. So we're 24/7 brewery, right? So we have our labs on everything. Our brewers are on top of everything. And so we can hit the mark and pull the trigger to dry hop when, like, the time is perfect. And I think that's critical. And again, that's so much science put into that. We've studied the shit out of our beers, and so
yeah. How do you know what the perfect temperature is, or then time to dry hop?
Trials. So, okay. Like, in the pilot, you know, let's say, I don't know, some voodoo that's going to come out and be a huge brand in 2025. We'll take samples constantly throughout the process. So obviously a cold aerated wort sample and pitch count sample and pre mid-firm dry hop, post-firm dry hop sample, all these things. And we're just giving those to our lab. And so our scientists say, hey, like, you know, the geraniol in this sucks. Then the next trial, we might change the mid-firm dry hop temp based on, like, whatever yeast we're using and the data we have from other trials. And then once we hit the mark, that's when it goes through a whole process. And finally, we call it deploy it. We'll send it to the production and hope that it's great. But yeah,
and
I think...
And then they can solve those problems in real time.
Once it hits production, it's out of our hands.
Sure. And they can make sure that, I mean, how do you track that? Because, I mean, scaling from a small pilot brew house that you all have to a production brew house where it's going to take, you know, a whole lot of turns to fill some of your larger tanks. I mean, and you're talking about whole different worlds of hydrostatic pressure and in these tall conical fermenters that can definitely change the way that, you know, yeast perform. I mean, that's kind of an amazing thing to scale in that way. How do you, you know, how do you all, you know, calculate for that kind of thing?
Just historical data. We have so much data on our house strains of yeast. And so whatever variables change, we can kind of go in and go, okay, well, again, this was done at this temp, or this fermented in this many hours, or once we added the hops, the slope of fermentation, you know, dipped in this way. So we can look at all that stuff. And again, we'll make the batches and the trials and the pilot, but we work with all of those other teams before it actually hits scale. And again, that's those experts weighing in on it. So, you know, there might be, if, I don't know, our fermentation temp is 18°C, but the lab thinks like, no, with that yeast and this hop profile or these natural flavors, whatever is going in there, which, shout out to them, but they can be like, I don't think that fermentation temperature should be right, up it to 20, and then we'll go for it. But yeah, we utilize all of those. They're there for a reason. And again, we make the main prototypes, but if it's not, if it wasn't for their expertise, we would probably be failing pretty bad.
Sure, sure. It's fascinating to me to see how those things happen and how process intensive it all gets, especially when you get into the kind of scale of production that New Belgium is at. But let's go back to small scale. Let's go back to, you know, some of the crazy projects that you just get to do as small one-offs that never have to go into larger production, but they get to express your own like creativity and your own vision for brewing. We're drinking one of them right now, Beer to Queer. You know, talk to me about your own creative process around this and how you, you know, go about designing a recipe that can stand up to fruit and or floral ingredients. You know, talk to me about walking through your own creative process and then how you went about creating the beer.
Beer to Queer. Yeah, Beer to Queer is one of my favorite beers I've made. I've been working on it for 5 years, at least. This beer actually started off, I didn't really want to make, I wasn't going for what was, I was going for a memory, right? So if anyone's been to Poipu Beach in Kauai, there's a place called Brenneke's Broiler, and I wanted to make a beer that reminded me of being there, drinking one of their Mai Tais. And I like their Mai Tais, so that's how I started the concept of this. It was originally called Kelly's Tropical Ale. So if you've ever seen it, that was its name before I just switched it into the Beer to Queer brand name. But I wanted to make something that tasted like you were at the beach chugging a Mai Tai. I didn't want it to be artificial. I would have never dreamed of putting natural flavors in it when I first started. So it's a lot of juice. And for me, this beer... I went through so many different citrus purees and fruits and all kinds of things to get like the right blend that wouldn't scrub out in fermentation. And the color, I used purple carrot powder, which is just fun. So it has like a tropical
purple carrot powder.
Oh yeah. That stuff's insane.
Oh yeah. Where do you get that from?
I don't know who Dave actually gets it from right now, but there's a handful of stuff out there that you can get for this kind of magenta color that's actually just from fruit or vegetables. So this one,
you didn't just go with Andy's hibiscus, did you?
There is hibiscus
that's Andy's
in
go-to,
here.
Andy Mitchell's go-to, you know.
There is hibiscus in here for like a pH adjustment and a little bit of astringency. But yeah, so I wanted to make something that tasted like that memory, and that's what I did. And it was crazy because after I made the first batch of it, so just a 10 hectoliter batch for fun, just like having a good time, I poured it for Soren, who you mentioned before, was one of our super tasters and has worked with you. And I shit you not, he was like, oh, this is great, you know, whatever. And he did know it was a Mai Tai inspired beer. So he said, have you ever been to Poipu in Kauai? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, have you ever been to the Brenneke's? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, this tastes just like their Mai Tais. I almost like fainted, not really, but I was like, that was my memory. And that's why I made that beer. And to have someone else say it, and I hadn't told anyone, that made me pretty proud. But anyway, I love this beer. It's got a little bit of kind of aged on rum-soaked oak. It's just rum chips, I guess, and it's just good.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of your previous attempts at this, you know, led to fruit scrubbing off and fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did you ultimately find ways to corral that? Are there some, you know, bigger offenders in terms of fruit varieties, in terms of fruit formats? You know, puree versus juice versus concentrate, you know, or you know, are there some, and what have you learned through that process of testing all these other means of getting fruit flavor into this beer?
So with this, I use all my stuff comes for this beer comes from a place in town called Source of Nature, Alex, and she actually used to work for New Belgium as our procurement specialist. So she's always had good relationships with vendors. So I know everything.
And she now does a lot of sourcing for independent breweries all over the place.
Everybody. Everybody. So her specific pineapple puree is incredible. So that's in there. I use burnt sugar syrup from Tippelman's, which is like a craft cocktail kind of thing for your drinks place. Anyway, so that's the sugar that's got that little, like, I don't know, it just layers it a little bit better. And then the best citrus fruit that I love it. I use it for any type of citrus beer I do is calamansi. It is just, I know it has a low pH, but it will just stick in solution. So orange, clementine, a lot of those, tangerine, you know, if you've brewed with them, you'll see like, oh, I put in like, so in a 10 hectoliter batch, you know, 20 kgs of tangerine, and it now, like, once the fermentation's finished, you don't smell shit. It's barely in there. And so calamansi, I love it, and I have a lot of experience with it. And then I actually use Lulo, aka Naranjillo. It's a type of fruit. It's actually technically a nightshade, but it gives like this thicker, it's like chewy almost after fermentation. And so it actually leaves a little bit of body in the beer.
I have never heard of this fruit. I consider myself a worldly person and have never heard of this fruit.
When I buy it from Alex, it's under the name Lulo, but it's also known as Naranjillo. I think it comes from Brazil.
Mm.
But yeah, Lulo, calamansi, burnt sugar, pineapple, hibiscus. There's a lot in this beer. So what's crazy about this is if we ever want to make 10,000 barrels of it, I do have a version that's scalable, but the one we're drinking right now is like the one where you just dump it all in. Yeah.
Max intensity.
Yeah.
All juice.
Yeah.
How do you, you know...
And it's 7.4%.
Well, okay. Okay. Are there any, you know, tricks to getting that integration, or how do you build a, you know, a beer base that can support some of these, you know, fruity flavors? Because this is also, as I look at it, I mean, I'm seeing this magenta color, but it doesn't look like there's a lot of yellow barley color in there either. It seems like you're working off a pretty light base beer.
It's just all Weyermann pills. For the base. And then a bag of Carapils. So very simple.
Yeah.
Huel Melon hops.
Is it a lager fermentation too, or is it just a very light ale fermentation?
I used to make it with a Kolsch strain, but now I just do it with, but there are some sulfury notes back in the day.
Sure.
But now I just use our house ale. It's very simple. And then what else is in there? And it's only 4 IBUs. This is literally just booze juice. It's a Mai Tai.
Well, it doesn't taste terribly sweet, yet it still conveys the kind of fruit flavor. How do you balance, you know, that, say, like drier finishing gravity, but still capturing this fruit character? I mean, I know that's one of those enduring challenges, right? Because we so associate a lot of these fruit flavors with the sweetness that comes along with them. And when you end up with beer that is a little bit drier, you know, it can actually work against that conveyance of the fruit.
There's a metric F-ton of puree and juice in there. Not so much that it would stall out fermentation or anything, but it's pretty chock full of fruit. The Trub Jane's on this beer are exciting. But yeah, I think that play with using more than just one type of juice, and the burnt sugar, I think, and the rum oak, I think they all just come together, but they're all subtle. So there's no like kapow flavor in there that's going to like kind of make you just get sick of it after a while. I think they just blend well and you can keep chugging it.
How do you go about these additions? Are you adding these hot side in order to pasteurize them through that boil process? Are these cold side additions? I mean, I imagine every you since you're getting a dry, you know, you're definitely re-fermenting these out. You know, but generally, how do you go about that?
In this particular beer, what's hot side on here? The burnt sugar syrup and the hibiscus. Everything else is mid-firm.
Okay.
So just opening the top, dumping it in. And for us, too, in our pilot, it's kind of, there's a level of risk for that because if anything at all is found by the micro team, we can't release it, anything. And so opening up, doing mid-firm, even
in the middle, this is why you're in the middle of the wood cellar with all of the wild culture floating around there. I see the problem now.
So turn off the
bait. They won't even let you keg it and put it in the tap room if there's
No. Oh, wow. No. And, you know, at other small places and where I used to work, it was like, especially back at the, I mean, you were testing some stuff, but it was like, oh, who knows? It'll be sold by the time it starts to get foamy and disgusting. No. So when I do those mid-firm additions, it's a little stressful, but I have a weird process for it. I have like we have all these like Sankey couplers with cones on them, welded onto them. And so we'll just put them in clean kegs, dump everything in, keep it sanitized, and like inject it into our sample cocks, just pushing with CO2. And that way it just mitigates exposure to just outside air. And again, a lot of the way we do stuff is because we're so terrified of all of those fooders.
Well, leads you to a process that works and that that's more closed and controlled.
Yeah, yeah. Because the last thing I want to do is, and any brewer wants to do, is work really hard on something and then you just have to dump it. It's terrible.
Sure, sure. How do you promote homogenization within that tank, you know, as it's moving? Because especially when you're dealing with purees and whatnot, stratification can occur, settling out. And the last thing you do with all of these expensive fruit ingredients, the last thing you want is to not get the kind of extraction that you're going for. Is there a, you know, a temperature stuff at play here where you find better extractions? You know, are you recirculating or, you know, how do you manage all that?
A lot of, if it's fruit additions, I try to, and it's not just me, I guess a lot of people on my team, we all try to add at like between 6 and 8 Plato. So there's still a lot of convection and circulation going on with the vigorous fermentation at that point. And that way, you know, like I said, or you were asking, but you'll kind of get movement of everything. And then another thing we do, even on the big systems, actually, depending on the brand. So if it was frambozen with all that raspberry or something, we'll do 12 and 24 hour post knockout CO2 bumps.
Hmm.
And we'll pulse it for 10 seconds. So obviously a sterile hookup at the bottom valve. And do a yeast strain first. And kind of get it down to clean yeast. And then anyway, you'll do 2 10-second pulses, 30 seconds apart. And that's worked. And again, only 10 seconds because you don't want to get too much CO2 in there. But yeah, that seems to have done the trick on a 10 hectoliter, a 360, 720, and a 1440. So yeah.
Oh, pulsing CO2 in a 1440 hectoliter tank. That's
burp it.
Absolutely wild.
Burp it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's zoom out as we finish up here, Kelly. You've gotten over the last number of years, you know, the opportunity to tackle a number of challenges. What are you most excited about in the future? What are some of the, I mean, obviously there's some proprietary things you're working on that you can't tell us about, but at the same time, you know, you're a brewer, you love the, you know, the creative aspect of this and pushing yourself. Where do you want to push next?
Oh, man. I love where I work. So I want to continue to be part of our innovation team at New Belgium. And I don't know, like I said, education's huge for me. So I think just as new type of non-traditional ingredients come into the mix for brewing, I'd love to just continue to work on getting a lot of experience with those and knowing how they perform because it's kind of unstoppable at this point. And so I used to be a very curmudgeon-y traditional brewer. And then my soul got crushed, not at New Belgium, but pre-New Belgium. And so I know the future is change. And that's kind of one thing we do say at New Belgium anyway, is the only thing that stays the same is that everything's changing. So I think just getting a better knowledge base by, and I'm not talking about like just natural flavor or anything like that. I'm saying like anything that starts to hit the market as a raw material, I'd like to just continue with that. And I don't know. Just not suck.
Well, here, cheers to not sucking. We'll close it on that note. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring. Schedule a time now to meet with ProBrew at CBC Booth 1783. Old Orchard is the go-to source for fruit-forward ingredients for some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape. Omega Yeast's Diastole Knockout Series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diastole before it starts. ABS Commercial are proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country. If you're a distiller or curious about it, check out the Craft Spirits and Distilling podcast. SS BrewTech is dedicated to an engineering-first approach to brewery equipment and powers R&D at some of the world's greatest breweries and build consistency with a reverse osmosis system from uswatersystems.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, go to beerandbrewing.com, click on that subscribe button. And if you become an all-access subscriber, you can even go watch the course on brewing with cannabis that we filmed last year with Ross Koenig, who's now of Second Dawn Brewing, but was once a part of that killer R&D team over at New Belgium. As we mentioned earlier on in the podcast, and if you know, of course, you can catch Kelly along with Natalie Rose Baldwin and Tanya Cornett and Megan Parisi on a panel at CBC this year in Las Vegas. I will be there as well. Can't wait. I will stop by and check that one out too. But Kelly, if people want to learn more about what you all do in the R&D program at New Belgium, where can they learn more about y'all?
Oh man, we're actually launching or working on a piece of our website that will encapsulate a lot of the collabs and things that I've been up to, and that'll include a lot of our R&D work too. Other than that, we're youngsters. I'm older, but Instagram, that's where we post all of our cool new stuff. So
fun. I should also mention those all access subscribers can see our video class with Lauren Limbach, who we also talked about on this episode. One of the most amazing people I know in the world of beer, and it's a phenomenal class on building a production level mixed fermentation and sour beer program. Kind of wild, obviously. Maybe not the hottest retail side of the beer world right now, but if there's anyone doing it well in this entire world, it is absolutely Lauren. Kelly, thanks for joining me here on the podcast. It's been fantastic and exciting and thought-provoking to dig into the New Belgium approach to R&D, obviously making such wildly successful beers out there in the market today. It's been great talking with you about brewing. Cheers.
Yeah, had a great time.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.